Hello, everybody. Can you hear me? Thank you. Thank you. That's my talk for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Okay. Well, welcome to the evening session. I'm not Danny Richter, but I will change it to Danny Richter shortly. But right now, I'm Rick Knight, Research Coordinator from Brookfield, Illinois. Hey. And back in 2016, some of you may remember when Marshall Saunders said, you know, when you get in a dire situation, the cavalry shows up. You are the cavalry. I always remember that. So I want to salute all of you people of the cavalry, those of you who are veterans and those who are new recruits. And thanks to CCL for giving me the opportunity to talk to the cavalry. But most of you are aware of the special report issued by the IPCC last month. And I'm here to dig a little deeper than what you may have read or heard so far. Okay, so the report in question is officially titled Global Warming of 1.5 Degrees C, also referred to as SR 1.5, by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's a tongue twister, or IPCC. In this talk, I'll address three main questions. Why was this report written? What does it tell us that's new? And how does it inform CCL's work? So first, why was this report written? Well, back in 2015, after 196 nations of the 21st Conference of Parties, or COP21, that signed the Paris Agreement, adopted an aspirational goal of 1.5 degrees C, they invited the IPCC to issue a report on the science around that target. It's good to understand that the IPCC is not the United Nations. I think we even heard some of the reporters on the panel refer to it as a UN report. But that can be misleading and make them even more of a target for some politicians. But it's actually an independent panel of hundreds of the world's leading climate scientists from nations on every continent, and they don't get paid for their work. This is not one of the regular assessment reports, or ARs, that are written by the IPCC every 7 years. The last one of those was AR5 in 2014, and AR6 is scheduled for 2021. But this one was requested specifically to focus on 1.5 degrees C. And this whole thing was posted last month on the website you see here, not as a final version, but as a draft, which they call by this most excellent name, a pre-trickle-back version. That's no relationship to trickle-down, I guarantee that. But here are the 16 documents. There we go. That make up most of the report, all of which can be downloaded by the public. It was written by 91 scientists and policy experts from 44 nationalities, including 7 from the US. On the left, you can see there's a short technical summary, then 5 chapters, 4 of which have more detailed technical supplements, and on the right side, a glossary, summary for policymakers, headline statements, press release, FAQs, and finally, this additional document, the changes to the underlying scientific technical assessment to ensure consistency with the approved summary for policymakers. Also informally known as the approved trickle-back version. That all adds up to 1,300 pages of stuff. It's really good stuff, but it takes some time to digest. But now on to our next question, which is, what does it tell us that's new? So first of all, we know a lot more now about the potential effects of 1.5 degrees C because a lot of people, about 20 to 40% of humanity, now lives in areas that have already exceeded that temperature rise. This map may be a little hard to see, but it shows in red the areas that have already gone there. You can see the most pronounced of these are in China and India. But there are also a lot of red dots in urban areas. Those of you in front can probably see those dots. A lot of areas that have surpassed 1.5 or 2 or even as much as 3 degrees C of warming in a few cases. So next, the report tells us something about the carbon budget we are facing. That's how much more we can burn. Ending up this century below 1.5 degrees C requires one of these things. Either reducing the net global emissions of long-lived greenhouse gases to zero before the cumulative limit is reached, or heavy reliance on net negative global emissions after the cumulative limit is reached. And it's estimated to fall within this range, 450 to 750 gigatons of CO2 equivalent. That's the remaining carbon budget from the beginning of 2018 that would give us a 2/3 chance of staying below 1.5 degrees C. And of course, it's frustrating not to have a more exact number, but the reason is that different models give different answers. So what's our current emissions rate? Anyone out there have a number?
37.
Last year it was 49 gigatons. So this is why you might have heard statements like, we have 12 years left to avoid the worst of climate change. Because 49 times 12 would put you right in the middle of this range. The report, 1.5 degrees C, implies certain benchmarks for cutting emissions. Specifically, by 2030, we need to cut from that 49 gigatons a year to 25 to 30 gigatons, that range. And by 2050, cut to net zero in order to stay below 1.5. And let's put this in a graph. The vertical scale is the percent cut from 2018 emissions, going from zero at the bottom to 100% at the top. And you can see the first square there is the 2030 benchmark, and next is 2050, again, to stay below 1.5 degrees. So let's compare that to the REMI forecast for the CCL plan, keeping in mind that REMI only projected 20 years ahead and for the US only, but taking that into account, here's what it would look like. It would be in the ballpark. As you can see, it comes pretty close, and the CFND final target of 90% below 1990 emissions is close to that. It's not quite zero emissions, but it's pretty close. All right, next. The report tells us that carbon dioxide removal, or CDR, will probably be necessary to some extent. CDR means practices that take CO2 out of the Earth's system. I also mentioned negative emissions in that last slide. It's not exactly the same thing. CDR refers to methods, and negative emissions means taking more CO2 out using those methods than you're putting in, than you're emitting. And I'll get back to how that relates to our policy a little bit later. But first, what are these methods? Two of them fall under the acronym of AFOLU. You might have noticed a lot of acronyms, and believe me, there'll be more. But AFOLU is agriculture, forestry, and other land use. These include, first, planting lots of trees, either where they've never been before, that's afforestation, or where they've been chopped or burned down, which is reforestation. The other AFOLU method is soil carbon storage, agricultural practices that can help restore organic carbon into the soil. Now, the other CDR method that gets its own acronym over on the right is BECCS, or biomass energy with CO2 capture and sequestration. Now, in this one, plants are grown, harvested, burned for energy, and the CO2 is captured and pumped down into geological storage reservoirs. BECCS is a little more controversial because of all the risk that profitable energy crops could compete and crowd out food crops in some areas. But in fact, these methods all present the risk of land use conflict and difficult policy design. The IPCC message is that all of these are controversial and risky. Reliance on such technology is a major risk. Now, this could be misunderstood. It doesn't mean, for example, that restoring healthy soil is risky. What the IPCC means here is that expecting these methods to save us from having to cut emissions is risky. We must not let their existence slow down our efforts to stop the emissions in the first place. And let me move this one up. Just to underscore that, to reinforce that point, here are four model pathways from the IPCC report that highlight different routes to 1.5 by the end of the century. The first one on the left represents the steepest decline in fossil fuel and industrial emissions, which is that gray area, and requires only a minor amount of CDR using AFOLU measures and no BECCS at all. The other pathways are increasingly prone to overshooting 1.5 degrees and consequently require more and more of this BECCS, which is in yellow. That's the carbon capture version. So, what does all this mean? I'll get to that later. Another lesson from the report. Carbon pricing is an essential part of any effort to meet 1.5. First, as quoted in the report, this is what they say, policies reflecting a high price on emissions are necessary. The price of emissions for limiting warming to 1.5 degrees C is about 3 to 4 times higher compared to 2 degrees C. And they say that investments in low carbon energy technologies and energy efficiency would need to approximately double in the next 20 years, while investment in fossil fuel extraction and conversion decrease by about a quarter. So those are some discrete goals there that were recommended. But let's look at some of the modeling that goes behind this. Now, this I'm going to have to take this a little bit slow. Economists don't like to predict anything more than 10 years ahead. If Jerry Hinkle were here, he'd tell you that. Let alone to the end of the century, but to satisfy COP21. Satisfy the COP21 request, they did this for the report. And this chart shows those model results for 2030, 2050, 2070, and 2100. I can't really point to it. Is there a laser pointer in this thing? You can't do that. Okay. Anyway, the blue bars are the 1.5 degrees C model results. They ran 21 different models under 67 different scenarios. And by scenarios, they mean different technology assumptions, different economic assumptions, and different temperature outcomes. So the blue bars are staying below 1.5 degrees C. The orange bars are staying below 2 degrees C. And the darker sections show the middle half of all the results. So they cover a wide range. And this is in terms of an implied carbon price, which is, for all practical purposes, the same thing as what we're talking about as a carbon fee. So, what does this nice graph tell us? They show that the carbon prices needed to stay under 1.5, and the blue, are generally higher than for 2 degrees, which won't surprise anybody. But there's also some overlap in those results. In 2030, for example, staying on a 1.5 degree path correlates to carbon prices between $157 and $6,000 a ton. While the 2 degree scenario gives prices from $12 a ton to $230. So there's some overlap there at the top end of the 2 degrees, the bottom end of 1.5. And as the years go by, of course, those price ranges move upward until the end of the century. For 2 degrees, it's $186 to $2,400. And for 1.5, between $800 and a very impressive $31,000 a ton for 1.5 degrees C. And those are huge ranges, which reflects how sensitive these models are to the assumptions that go into them. But let's see where the carbon fee and dividend stacks up in this. Whoop, we got it here, okay? The dotted line curve is a CFD price, and normally we would stop at 2050 because that's where we were going to get down to zero emissions. But if we extend it all the way to 2100, it looks like this. So you can see that laid on top of the IPCC modeling data, the CFD price line is solidly in the 2-degree range and even touches the lower part of 1.5. This means that the carbon fee and dividend, if applied worldwide, could theoretically keep that global temperature well under 2 degrees and maybe even close to 1.5 degrees C. And there are, of course, some caveats to that, keeping in mind CCL's policy is designed for the U.S., so we should be cautious in extrapolating it to all nations. But there's another thing, for purposes of argument, another thing to keep in mind is that the CFD language does allow for annual fee escalation to be boosted from $10 a ton to some higher number if administrators determine that emissions targets are not being met, and that emissions targets that are stated in legislation. So let's suppose that at some point, let's say 2025, the annual increase is boosted to $15 a ton. So here's what that would look like. It would put the price trajectory up a little further into the 1.5 range. So it confirms that even by itself, our policy, as we present it, could get most of the job done in principle. So finally, let's hear it for carbon fee and dividend. Yeah. So how does the IPCC report inform CCL's work? Our first takeaway should be that we are on the right track. Driving down fossil fuel emissions must be the first step. And a rising price on fossil carbon is by far the best way to get that to happen. Now look at this graphic again. Okay? The longer it takes to get rid of that gray section, it's the fossil CO2 emissions on the left, the more we would end up having to implement CDR measures, with all the uncertainty and potential conflict that that would entail. Thank you. We want to end up here, not here, where we'd have to be sucking 20 billion tons of CO2 out of the environment each year. So, okay, now another thing. Models are conservative in their economic assumptions, meaning that the carbon fee impacts are very likely to be stronger than the models can show. Okay, so what does this statement mean? Whether the policy itself can help lead to breakthroughs. What this means to me is that modeling based on today's technologies and yesterday's economy always fails to take into account new conditions, in this case, a predictably rising carbon price. So there has never been a test of how this can mobilize the collective imagination of millions of problem solvers, from the guy who runs a donut shop to some physicist at Oak Ridge, or a building contractor in Houston, or a dairy farmer in Wisconsin. When everyone participates in this problem solving, that's policy-induced innovation, and that's what the carbon fee and dividend can do. So, looking to the future, does anybody here think that when we pass the carbon fee and dividend, they can just go home, pat themselves on the back, and bake some cookies? Sounds nice, but that's not the way I think. That's not the way I see it. Once a carbon fee is on the books, the next steps will begin to emerge. The CFD is designed to drive down fossil fuel emissions by recycling fossil fuel money back into the economy. As the fossil fuels go away, so does the money. So we can't bring about negative emissions under that mechanism if such are really needed. But we simply don't know at this point. Our job is now to get that mechanism in place, make that huge first step, so we can find out from real-world data. Danny, data. Instead of relying on models. So again, looking to the future, where can we at CCL continue to leverage this influence that we've built to influence further steps that need to be taken to ensure a livable climate? In our Spanish name, that's clima vivible, livable climate. That's something our leadership and our board are already thinking about. So let me wrap up this way. Here are the lessons we learned from the IPCC SR 1.5 report. It validates that carbon pricing is the best first step to minimize the impacts of climate change. It also mentioned that complementary policies can greatly boost the effectiveness of carbon pricing. The prices modeled by the IPCC assumed that there are no supportive policies like R&D funding or state and local programs. Induced innovation can speed up decarbonization. Most of the models cannot account for the impact of a long-term predictable carbon pricing plan on the emergence of new ideas, large and small, and everywhere in between. And remember, our policy also states that the annual fee escalation can be increased if necessary. So my final message is, freak out over the IPCC report, but don't freak out. Instead, keep calm and price carbon, and I'll stop there. Thanks. Gracias. Muchas gracias.